informed and unspun. This is The Big Picture.
Hello, this is The Big Picture on URN 1350. I'm Elliot Johnson, I'm your presenter tonight, and today we're going to be talking about the real exciting things that are going on in today's political landscape and what else around the world. We've got the Royal Mail coming up as a good issue affecting all people across the nation. We've got Nairobi and what's been going on, sadly, in Africa. And also after that, we've got the SU Rugby. Yes, the rugby union team has been banned for a little while. Please listen in. You can do that on the website, 1350.net, and on there you can text as well. There's a little box. Send your text in there for free text. Or if you want to use the telephone, you can text us on 077-622-12434. And so, I think, let's go to... Oh, no, let's introduce the panellists first. On my left, we have...
Johnny.
I'm David. I'm a PhD student studying criminal justice.
And on my right...
Good evening, Elliot. I'm Luke, and I'm a second-year student studying law.
I'm Seb. I'm a second-year politics student.
Excellent. So, let's get cracking, shall we? So, firstly, as you probably all know, 50% of Royal Mail has been sold off. It's been privatised by the government. The shares were sold at £3.30 earlier this week, and late last week, and they closed today at £4.89. So the vast majority of people have, a lot of people have invested in the shares, and the vast majority of those have been people investing at £7.50, and the government has guaranteed that they've all got shares. And these people who've invested at £7.50 have made a 50% profit on what they invested at. Those over over £10,000 will get no shares at all. Full-time members of the Royal Mail will also be getting shares. They'll be getting 725 free shares, and altogether they were worth £3,545 yesterday. Vince Cable and the CEO of the Royal Mail have said this is a good thing, and they said that the starting price was right, but Labour have said this was bad. They do not agree with the privatisation of the Royal Mail. Now, also interestingly, Chukwuma Numa has said that the shares were sold too cheaply, although many people have disagreed with him. So I'm going to ask the panel this to start off. Were the Royal Mail shares sold too cheaply?
Yeah, I think they probably were. I think that it was a shame that they were sold in the first place, to be honest. But, I mean, as you can tell by the fact that they've gone up quite exponentially after being sold, shows that they were massively undervalued by the incompetent government.
I think Johnny's more or less right here. I do think that there has been a level of underselling. It's clear that the government could have put a higher value on the shares initially sold. I mean, I have a certain amount of sympathy with the argument that these sorts of things are always going to get a huge initial boost in terms of the price that people are willing to pay for them, because this is a very big moment for the country in terms of privatization. And it's interesting in that regard. What it means in that regard, rather, is that you will see a massive rise, no matter what you put it at. But it's clear that by the very level that they were initially sold at, that there has been an issue there. And, you know, I think the government has let the taxpayer down in that regard.
Yeah, I think certainly they have been, the price was set to. I think that is shown, as both David and Johnny have said, by the increase in prices. Now, I think the reason for that is perhaps, given it was a very controversial, remains a controversial, politically controversial sale and privatisation, I think the government were probably very anxious to avoid a lack of people buying. They didn't want to set it too high. People say no one wants to buy shares, and that would have been politically disastrous. So whether it was just incompetence or slightly more politically calculated manoeuvre to make sure to err on the side of caution, to make them too cheap, and also avoid the charge of, you know, outpricing, you know, normal people, where the government intentionally did it slightly more cheaply than it needed to as political cover.
Just quickly, Johnny wants to say something, but I just want to ask him beforehand, what do you say to people like Vince Cable and the CEO of Royal Mail, who say it's up to the markets to decide what the price of the shares would be, not for the government?
Well, I would say that it's a point of contention for everyone. I think that Vince Cable shows his true colours as not a very good lefty by coming into office and making this a standing point for him. I mean, don't forget, even Thatcher was clever enough not to privatise the Royal Mail. She said she wouldn't want to sell the Queen's face, which I think is what's happened. I don't agree with it. I just think that it was a very odd thing for them to come and do. And at the end of the day, it's one of those things that it doesn't really work on its own in the market. It's there's so many laws set around it that it's just a silly thing to have done.
Okay, so let's broaden that out. As you've said there, Johnny, was it right to privatise the Royal Mail, Luke?
Yes, it was, and there are going to be those people. I understand there are a number of people who would say that they oppose the privatisation of Royal Mail. And as with issues that we've discussed before, with tuition fees, that sort of thing, the reason why people oppose it is because those people who just have an ideological opposition to it, such as a number of people I'd say in this studio, they are deliberately trying to suggest that there's some kind of loss of service or some kind of practical disadvantage to people, when ultimately that's not true. Now, what we've got here is not your standard case of simply opening up the postal market to everyone. What we have here, as a result of the Postal Services Act, which was passed in preparation of this, is a number of measures which ensure we will have a universal postal service. Johnny mentioned the idea of selling the face of the Queen. Ironically, within that bill, there is a section which says that anybody who is providing this universal service, anyone who is taking over the Royal Mail, is going to have the face of the Queen on the stamp. That is how meticulous this whole process has been. Ultimately, I think the opposition that comes to privatisation, unless it's based on sheer bloody-minded ideology, is going to be because people are confused about the actual effect that privatisation will have. The real effect is going to be very, very minimal for people. What it will mean for Royal Mail themselves is that they can invest in the future, have access to a wider range of capital in a better way than they have before, allowing them and supporting their innovation.
I'm going to amaze Luke by partially agreeing with him there. It's I think if you're going to privatise something, this is the way to privatise it. It recognises the fact that Royal Mail sits in a natural monopoly position. It's better to have one central provider of this kind of thing so that everyone can use the same channel, is incurring the same costs. There's a lot of certainty there. And I think there's definitely an argument that that's for the benefit. It's just going to be owned by a wider range of people. Moreover, the fact that the government are retaining a 50% stake in it, at least for the moment, suggests that it is going to be something where the government is still able to maintain a certain amount of control over the enterprise, which quashes to a certain extent those sorts of arguments about this is going to mean a loss of services automatically, this is going to mean a rise in prices automatically. I still think there are concerns there because it sets a very dangerous precedent. I'm trying not to make a slippery slope argument because I hate them, but it sets a very dangerous precedent that then allows future governments to sell off some of their stake increasingly and gradually give it away to private companies. And I think then you are likely to see much more interest in the profitability of Royal Mail over the actual services that it provides. But compared, for instance, to the privatisation of the probation service, which is being rushed through at the moment, I think this is a much better way to think about it.
But there's still the protection that they're in the statute. I mean, you've spoken about the option that governments might have to sell off the share that they own in it. But you know much more than I do, having studied law for much longer than I've probably been around, if I may say so. That as a politely as possible. The point is, what I'm saying is that's a statute. That's not to do with the shares. That is something that must be provided by whoever it is that is running the Royal Mail. That's something that can't be overruled unless somebody else is going to come in and wipe out the Postal Services Act. That's something that I would oppose. The Postal Services has been passed by this government for a reason, and that's to ensure that the heritage and the service that we can expect from the Royal Mail will continue. And I think if it were to come, the only threat to that is somebody else repealing it. And the political pressure that would go with that, as we've seen in this instance, would mean that would be pretty much impossible.
I accept that point. All I'm saying is it allows them to put that onto the political agenda in the future. It's a step which is now conceivable that wasn't conceivable before. And I think we have to be alert to that. And, you know, you're right, we have to think about whether we want that.
I think we've seen far too many times now the idea of things in written form not quite working out well in the real world. I mean, we've seen with G4S and the Olympics, for example. And coming back to the fact that, you know, I believe in this as an ideological argument, and I know that Luke doesn't like that very much, but I think that it's a monopoly business that makes sense to be owned by the country that's running it. And I don't see why you would want private investment in something like this. I understand that, you know, it opens it up to further investment and whatnot, but it's a profitable company. They can run like a normal company and put profits back into it.
But now it truly can be run by the people. We've heard the people who are working for Royal Mail have been granted a number of shares. They've had the option, as a result of a favourable deal that was negotiated, to get even more shares in that. The people who are involved in Royal Mail, whether that is people working for them or people just outside, can be involved, and they can actually be involved, which is more than simply saying you're involved through having the government running it. This is a much better option.
But what happens when those people are unfortunately sacked because they can't afford to keep them on because it's a monopoly business that doesn't make sense to run it as a privatised
Royal
idea.
Mail have had to make savings, and in doing that they have got rid of people as the nature of the postal industry has changed over the course of the last few years. That's not something that would change. As innovation has happened, we have seen jobs lost, and okay, they probably will continue to see jobs lost, but that's not a unique factor of privatisation. That was happening when it was owned by the government as well.
What does Seb want to say about this?
Thank you. I think the first point to make is, Luke, you've said that some of the opposition, and I doubt there is, to his privatisation, but we've got to remember, obviously, there is also ideological arguments in favour of privatisation. There are many people in favour who, I think there's ideological arguments from both sides. Having said that, I would agree that it does seem to be a much better managed privatisation than many, and I think it can work given, say, the postal bill and protections in place. So I think it can work as a privatisation. I would say that the Mrs. Thatcher's criticism of us not wanting to sell the Queen's head seems fairly strange given the Queen's face is intrinsically on money itself, and so trading that seems to be a strange opposition to it on that basis. But I think it's tough to say in some cases. As Johnny said, the G4S turned out to be terrible, and certainly there have been some cases of privatisation going terribly badly, but that has worked in the past. I'm not entirely sure I'm as good enough a soothsayer to predict how well this one's going to go, but I think the way it's set up shows it could go that way. But I, unlike other people on this panel, including the host, I'm not confident enough to put my money where my mouth is on that
one. The host is neutral, Seb.
I am very neutral.
While he's on air, he is anyway, or he'll get it.
I could read out some quotes, but I'm not going to.
I just wanted to come in and say, I think that it's strange. Being in a monopoly position like it is, we're now actually going to be paying pretty much the French government to be building nuclear power stations in this country. And I don't understand why we're selling off so much of things that we need to work properly in this country and not have a belief in our own government to run these things.
Right. I want to talk a little bit about the worker and also the, I'd say, working class engagement with this privatisation. Everybody who invested £750. Sorry, I'm terrible at numbers. You can see I'm a historian. £750. They've all got shares, and anybody who wanted to invest over £10,000 has no chance of getting shares. And also think about how only 0.24% of the workforce of Royal Mail are not getting shares because they opted out from it. What does anybody think about that? David.
Well, I think it's an interesting approach, and it's certainly a lot more progressive in its approach to privatisation than a conservative-led coalition government could have been, which is interesting, and I think it reflects the widespread popular support for the Royal Mail as an institution, you know, viz. Margaret Thatcher. What I will say is, you know, £750 is still quite a lot, especially if you're a working-class family. People are still frozen out of that ownership. And that's something that's inevitably going to happen as part of, you know, an introduction of the element of capitalism into this. And this is something that Luke unfortunately can't respond to, but this is kind of in response to his earlier point that, you know, this opening up of shares to the public market is some sort of democratic moment. It really isn't, because it excludes the very poor from that. And, you know, you can make the argument that they were already excluded from decision making beforehand. But I do think there's we can't get too rosy-eyed about this.
Just so you know, Lucas had to leave us early. He hasn't, like, died or anything on the set.
Not that we're aware of.
Going to sing some country and western songs or something. Seb.
Or preach hate.
That's harsh.
Sorry.
Come on, Seb.
Thank you. I'd agree with Dave in saying that certainly it's good that there's been these measures in place, you know, £750, make sure everyone's, you know, can supposedly, or at least more people can get shares in there. Spread out, but I certainly also agree with Dave saying that £750 certainly is still a lot of money for many people, so a lot of people will be frozen out. But I think it's certainly on an improvement on what it could have been. So it's kind of again a mixed bag on that one. It's better that it's not just here, you know, sell them freely and leave control to everyone. But I'd also agree with Johnny saying that, you know, we shouldn't necessarily assume that. I think we should have some faith in government and ownership as well, and, you know, giving shares to people and. The free market isn't the only way to give, you know, people power. We can have, you know, things run by the state and give people a say in that. So don't assume that the only way you can ensure people have power in these industries is to give them shares.
Johnny?
I do think that it shows that this is a kind of a liberal-led thing in the fact that it, I have to admit that it is being run reasonably fairly with reasonably cheap bottom-out levels. Obviously, £10,000 is more than a lot of people can afford, and £750 is still a lot more than a lot of people can afford. But it is almost affordable by most people with jobs and savings and whatnot. So I do think that it's it has been dealt out quite fairly.
Oh, that was almost pro privatization there, Johnny.
It wasn't.
Oh,
it really wasn't.
Almost pro privatization. Right, we're back on the big picture, and now we're going to be debating Nairobi. But before that, please keep texting in. You can go onto the website, 1350.net, and little text box, so please go in there. We have some new panellists as well. We have...
Alexander Fitzgerald, second year biochemistry student.
And we have...
We've got Bhavik Patni. I study mechanical engineering in my second year.
And...
Kieran Merchandani-Cooper. I do politics and American studies, second year.
Okay. Well, let's move on to the sad news that Kenya, on the 21st of October, witnessed quite a horrific terrorist attack. September, upon the Westgate shopping mall. The terrorists seized the mall and began to fire upon civilians indiscriminately. And 61 civilians were killed, including 6 British, and 6 members of the security forces were also killed in a siege which lasted for 4 days. The attack was carried out by the Al-Shabaab group, which is from Somalia and also has very strong links to Al-Qaeda. In fact, I think they're a part of Al-Qaeda
now. They are affiliated now.
Yeah, they are.
There are reports also that Kenya could have done more to stop this, as the Israelis had sent warnings to the government in August about the likelihood of such an attack. And also, the US have stepped on into the scene on a very close related note with commando raids across Africa. First, I'd like to ask... the panel, what has caused Al-Shabaab to carry out these attacks in Kenya?
I think I'll go first. Well, the recent history of Al-Shabaab in Somalia itself, it has been in dire straits because they're really being affected hard by the international, the African Union force in Somalia at the moment. So within the actual leadership of Al-Shabaab, there's massive factional infighting. There was recently the famous American, or they called him Al-Amriki because he was the American jihadist, and he had his own Twitter page and he was able to promulgate the Al-Shabaab's view across Twitter. So he was eventually disowned from Al-Shabaab, and they currently are at, he was eventually kicked out of Al-Shabaab. So there is currently a power struggle within Shabaab, and that's what caused them to try and target Westgate. They would use it as a recruiting tool because these huge mass events are a great recruiting tool for stuff like Al-Qaeda, for Al-Shabaab, for whether it be across the Middle East community. So that's why I personally, and what the information I've seen, why Al-Shabaab currently did it this exact time, as well as for the reason they gave us because of Kenyan presence in Somalia.
Yes, and just to add to that, Alex, very recently, this is last year, the Kenya army went to Somalia and took control of one of their main ports. It's called Kismayu. This is known as the Al-Shabaab stronghold, and it's a big channel for illegal trade. So Al-Shabaab will have problems with access to finance now, because where they get all their money from is not going to be accessible anymore now, because Kenya is in control of Kismayo.
I think you're right that there are certainly a lot of sort of push factors from the Kenyan involvement in and their relatively successful progress so far in attempting to restore sort of statehood to Somalia. On top of that, I'd perhaps say that I do think the affiliation with Al-Qaeda is significant. I think there's a certain amount of a pull factor there, that there's a sense of, A, having to prove themselves as part of this sort of, the Premier League, to use a completely inappropriate example, of terrorism organisations. But also, I suppose, in a sense, the sort of the boost that gives to them as an institution in terms of their own self-confidence to feel that they can do something on this scale. I think they're definitely both important factors as to why this has happened now.
I'll just make a quick point. It was it's a general point about basically the Al-Qaeda franchise. Mm. Never before, since 9/11, have Al-Qaeda had such a large recruiting base, have such a large presence in many countries. Basically, Syria, with the Al-Nusra Front, huge alliance there. So Syria there. Iraq, currently experiencing massive waves of bombings. There's in Mali, I mean, in northern Mali, and in across Algeria, across North Africa, across the Middle East, they haven't had as big a presence as they had for many, many years, and we should be worried.
Just quickly on that, though, Alex, what do you think of, in general, then, the Al-Qaeda, the loss of leadership in Al-Qaeda? Does it even matter?
Well, I think their natural leadership was centred around Afghanistan, Pakistan, that tribal border. But due to the American policy of drone attacks and targeted killings, the leadership there has been decimated, been cut short, and people, rather than worrying their next attack abroad, they're worrying about the drones are flying overhead, or whether they should bomb the local politician's convoy, which actually happened recently, a few days ago. So I think, but the leadership has disseminated, has fractured. There's leaders now like Mukhtar Belmukhtar in Algeria, who recently attacked the In Aminas pipeline scat line. So I think that's the problem. You cut the snake, cut the head of the snake, more snake's head pop out.
Yeah, I think Alex is broadly right there. Again, he tends to be about these sorts of issues. He knows a lot more than most other people who take part on this show, it's fair to say. I think, though, with the massive expansion of Al-Qaeda membership, I think it is definitely a cause for concern. I don't want to underline that. But I think at the same time, you see with that a massive relaxation of their sort of terms of admission, if you see. Well, for instance, I forget exactly who it was, but there was a senior Al-Qaeda cleric who came out against Al-Shabaab in the past, essentially saying that they're far too extreme and that they don't fit the Al-Qaeda value base. And I think that could be really interesting in terms of what happens to Al-Qaeda after this, because it gets so bloated and because this Hydra has grown so many heads after the collapse of the...
Yeah, it was the Hydra, not the snake thing.
It's all right, I got the mythology covered. What could happen then is schism, is complete collapse of the organisation. And I don't necessarily say that that will be a good thing for regional peace, but it will certainly affect the ability of organisations like Al-Shabaab to make these forays in the future.
Okay, as I said, Israel, as reports, Israel had sent warnings to the Kenyan government in August and September about a possible attack, sort of like this, on the Westgate Shopping Centre. So I would like to ask, what could Kenya have done to stop this, and what can they do in the future to avoid anything like this happening again?
Well, I think there's... I was reading an article recently about this recruiter, I can't remember his name, Mutab something. There's a recruiter in Kenya who recruits openly for Al-Shabaab. You can find his street name, you can find him anywhere. And so I think they can cut down the recruiting tools, they can cut through the recruiting streams, because like Bavik said, they go through, there's this island that's just off the coast of Somalia, which they go from Kenya to the island, and then it's a free boat ride to Somalia and the Port of Kismayo, which has recently been cut off. Another thing is cutting the international supply of foreign jihadists, because just on a note related to the UK, the recent killing of Lee Rigby, the Nigerian man who did it, was actually picked up by Kenyan security forces trying to get in Somalia. Yeah. And that's just another point to bear in mind.
No, I definitely support that. I think while there are concrete things that they could have done, I also think it's important not to lambast them too much, especially over the Israeli intelligence, because, you know, hindsight is 2020. And I think broadly they are doing more or less the right thing at the moment. They're pursuing a valid course, which is to try and restore order in Somalia. Terror really thrives in disorder and poverty, in the sense that there is something, an international order to rebel against, to utterly condemn. And that allows extremism to spread, and that's one of the roots of terrorism. Obviously, it's a very complex question. And so by attempting to go in and restore some sort of unitary state authority in Somalia, I think the Kenyans are doing something credible to stop al-Shabaab, and that's one of the reasons why al-Shabaab has now turned against them. So I think, you know, while we can have the perennial discussion about whether it's acceptable to go in and change states and things like that, the Afghanistan question, I think if they are committed to going down that line, I think they're doing it in the right way, because they've got the support of the African Union. They're doing it as part of a regional position, which prevents the sort of the arguments of Western interference and neo-imperialism coming in. So we can criticize, but we shouldn't lose sight of the fact that this is an inevitability when dealing with terrorist organizations of this size and scale. These attacks are going to happen.
No, that's right. And also, I do think that I think that the internal security in Nairobi should have been heightened. Reports suggest that there were some warnings that there was going to be an attack, between August and September this year, and they even knew that they're going to target, the main shopping malls and maybe parliament buildings and the likes. So there was no such heightened security internally, and this would have been a big measure that the Kenya Defense could have taken. Maybe they could have put some more armed personnel at the mall, and restricted and been a lot more put a lot more scrutiny on whoever enters the building.
Because I think there was there's quite a lot of Somali community in northern Nairobi, isn't
Yeah,
there?
Very, very big, very big Somali community. This is an area which they call the Little Mogadishu. It's called Eastleigh, and there are about 350,000 Somalis living there. And actually, they say that that could be a really big ground for al-Shabaab to be able to grow and recruit and even build houses and store ammunition. A lot of al-Shabaab must be, growing in there.
I mean, the point I was going to make just now, actually, is you've got to remember, it isn't that long since the violence surrounding, was it the 2008 elections? They're still under investigation by the International Criminal Court over that.
I think the guy below the president had to be. He was in the Hague while Escape Mall happened.
That's right. Yeah.
And so what they've got this whole distraction to deal with. They've got this whole cultural phenomenon to deal with. This whole coming to terms with that, and it's going to have a lasting effect on the infrastructure. And we have to accept that they're not in the perfect position to resist this violence at this time. But also, I think just to come back on what the others have said, while there is an argument for saying, okay, we know there's this security issue in Little Mogadishu, we know that there's all of these potential avenues for people to come in, you also have to not go down the avenue that Britain went down during the bad old days of the war on terror. You have to not go down the ways of racialized, ethnicalized, that's not a word, ethnic stop and search, profiling and that sort of thing, because I think that only helps to exacerbate the situation. I think we need to keep track of our own humanity while we're dealing with inhumane acts.
I think I read many reports about the good things you can take from this event is that after the attack there was a huge coming together in Kenyan society. There was like people from across racial divides, across religious divides coming together. There were thousands of people going to donate blood. There were people volunteering while the siege was actually happening to try and like take out bodies and stuff. So it's been a great unifier. I mean, Uhuru Kenyatta's speech after the event was a great unifying aspect. He talked about the fact that his own nephew and fiance died in the attack, and his son and sister actually escaped from Westgate Mall. They were actually there when it happened. So I think there is definitely hope. I mean, I'm hopeful, and I think the world should be hopeful, and the global community should help Kenya in any way it can, whether it be training security forces with intelligence, with all panoply of different methods.
Oh, well, that's interesting you mentioned the world, because that's where we're going to go now. I'm going to talk about this sort of globally.
Feel free to bring in any other countries, but we can talk about the US as well, because quite soon afterwards, they launched a number of commando raids across Africa. There were more than two, but one of them targeted the leader of Al-Shabaab, which has seemingly failed because they haven't got him. And there was another target in Libya, which is Abu Anas al-Libi, which is not his real name, but that's what they call him. Yes, and he's now charged for attacking the US embassy in 1998. John Kerry said this was legal and proportionate, but Libya have been immediately asking for an explanation. So let's discuss that and any other countries in the world. David?
I think, yeah, John Kerry needs to restock his quotation marks if he's going to call what happened there legal. I mean, it takes us back to those bad old days of the war on terror. It takes us back to extraordinary rendition. It takes us back to extrajudicial assassinations and kidnappings. And I think it's interesting that the US is doing it now. It's interesting that the Obama administration is so involved in it. Of course, Obama himself has very strong links with Kenya. But I don't mean to say that that's what's led to this policy on behalf of the US. I hope it's a ripple in the pond. I don't think it's going to do any lasting good for them to engage in this kind of global paramilitary activity. Because it only serves to muddy the waters of international law, and I think it weakens the foundation on which we actually can go after these people. I think Alex is right. I think what we can be doing now is supporting the nations that have been the victims of this, supporting the African Union in taking its own proactive action and avoid the charge of being neo-colonial oppressors.
I completely disagree, I have to say. I mean, these are people, these aren't democratic states. These are people who have completely decided to rid themselves of any form of law, and actually to be able to abolish them completely through military ways.
So we sink to their level. Pardon? We sink to their level by ignoring international
law. It's not that we sink
ourselves
to their level, it's that we get rid of them in a very sharp and concise manner. You can't take them, they can't naturally ask them to go to The Hague or something like that, and you've actually got to target them in a way that's much more concise. And if that means military action, then we have to do that.
I think I would agree on the matter, personally. I think it's a global war on terror. It's obviously been called that. And in war, certain rules have to be... There are different rules to that in peace. So,
well, yeah, and they're breaching those laws as well. It's international humanitarian law, the law of armed conflict. We can have this discussion, but, you know, it's going to go on at length, and I want to let other people get in on this. But I think we don't sink to that level. We get involved with the states themselves. The difficulty with Somalia is that it's been allowed to fester on a quagmire of complete and utter anarchy. And I use that inadvisably because I hate using the word anarchy in a pejorative sense, but still, of statelessness, if you can call it that. And I think that's only exacerbated the problem, which is why perhaps it worked, the strike worked in Libya, but not in Somalia, because there aren't those links there. It remains to be seen whether this causes a new war on terror. I really hope it doesn't, because I think that would be the wrong road to go down.
Okay, then. Well, that brings it to the end of our debate on the sad Nairobi attacks. And now we are going to turn to one of the debates, a student debate tonight, which is about the university rugby team, which has been banned from playing rugby from April the 24th to the 20th of June, which is 57 days. This is because the SU has taken action against initiation ceremonies that apparently break their rules, which they've said they break their rules. The rugby team ran into problems in October 2012 after a fathers and sons event, that's what they call it, which the union said breached their rules because they featured excessive volumes of alcohol, nudity, humiliation and coercion. This investigation was triggered because of another thing that the rugby team did when somebody on the rugby team, and we don't know who, pooed in a sink. The dates of this ban actually mean that the rugby team misses the varsity event, and so therefore there will be no varsity rugby at all this year. So, sorry, rugby fans.
Well, presumably there's still female rugby. I mean, they're not banned.
Oh, no, there's this is rugby, males rugby union. Mm. So rugby leagues taking place and female stuff, but rugby union's
the most popular one,
I think. And there's also been long-term wrangling about this because obviously, as I said, October 2012, this is when it happened. There were a few appeals to this process and this is the final decision that has been made. So I'm going to ask, should the rugby team be banned for their actions, from playing because of their actions?
Yeah, I think they totally should. I mean, you look at the charges that have been levelled against them, things like excessive alcohol consumption. Okay, we can have a discussion about that. The SU doesn't ban alcohol related discussion. There is supposed to be a non-alcoholic alternative. What? How can you police that? The more serious issues are things like the issues over humiliation and forcing people to do what the things against their will. I believe that refers to an incident where the defecator, if you will. I said that really weirdly.
Is that like the Terminator?
Something like that, only, you know, a bit smellier. where he was forced to strip as a punishment for his activity. I might have got that wrong, but that's, as I understand, one example of what happened. And I think that's totally out of step. That's totally unacceptable in a modern inclusive university. And I think the SU has to come down on this kind of conduct, because it at the end of the day, it's a form of violence against that person. I'll go that far. It's a form of violence. And I think we need to take steps to protect people from having to be forced into a position where they feel that they have to do this.
Very quickly, David, as a legal scholar, do you think about implied consent on this, you know, legally?
It's an interesting question. Implied consent, it's very difficult to imply consent. It only happens in a certain number of circumstances. And I don't think this comes into that.
It has to be rough.
Rough horseplay or something like that, and I think this clearly oversteps that mark. I mean, you look, for instance, at the definition of degrading treatment for the purposes of the European Convention on Human Rights, which is for the purposes of our Human Rights Act, one of the greatest sets of legislation ever to be put into this country, but we'll save that debate for another time, which essentially defines degrading treatment as anything which is calculated to humiliate. You also look, there are clear elements where, whilst you might consent to certain acts of interference, shall we say, on the part of sporting clubs, that only tends to extend towards things on the pitch. It only tends to work for relatively minor incidental and accidental acts.
Okay, Kieran.
Ah, if only David could follow every round with his big law book. Look, the fact of the matter is that ultimately, at the end of the day, whilst for you it may sound disgusting, it's for the person to decide. It's for the person to decide what their idea of fun is, what their idea of a good time is, and what they want to do when they're drunk, right? If this person, I already see the hands coming up, and I already see people giving me the looks and everything. If this person feels that they were hard done by, if this person feels that they were treated unnecessarily and unkindly, don't know the details, he might have, then he is his right to go to the SU and complain. If no one has complained and no one feels that they are hard done by, why are the SU coming in with such a hard level and banning something which is not only important for the rugby team, but important for a large population of this university? Not for me, I don't understand rugby. For a lot of people, it is.
Johnny?
I have to say, I mean, I've personally really enjoy watching rugby. I think it's a fascinating sport. I feel genuinely gratified by Elliot playing a little sound clip for me. Thank you very much.
I like rugby too.
Well, that's good to know. Something we can agree on. Wow, who would have thought? I just think that rules are in place to protect people. And people obviously do things that they regret when they're drunk. And I think initiations is part of that kind of the culture that the rules are there to designed to stop. I mean, I'm quite a strong-headed person, and I'm generally not pushed into things I don't want to do. But I mean, I'm sure there are kind of young freshers coming into the university who aren't exactly strong-minded people. They get into situations that they don't want to be in, and they're the kind of people that the rules are there to protect, and if one of the clubs isn't upholding one of those rules, whether they've been a complaint or not, the rules are there to be abided by.
Seb?
I've never been involved in any of these sports team initiation things, which anyone who knows me probably won't be too surprised by. But hear stories about initiations, and they do certainly seem quite scary, very intense, to put it mildly, experiences across the board. And it certainly seems easy to imagine it being the situation where the coercion from your teammates is very strong, particularly if you're under a lot of alcohol, but you're pressured into doing things, and in order to fit in and avoid other ostracization by the team, you have to do things you wouldn't necessarily want to do. And I think it's crucial that, although, of course, we want to promote team spirit and, you know, allow these teams to have good times, there's suddenly a line. I think initiations of this kind clearly cross it and make initiations a very dangerous and unpleasant environment. And I think laying down a law like this suggests that, you know, this is far beyond the pale.
Okay, I think there's a reason why there are some societies, like the Rugby Society, which do initiations, and there's a reason why when I joined the Politics Society, I had to do no such thing like that, because if you took a kid from a Politics Society, blindfold him, got him drunk, and then ran him around Lenton for 2 hours, they'd tell you where to go, right? Because that's not what they're expecting from their society. The people who, to kind of basically generalise, the people who join a rugby...
Because that's what this show's about.
That's what all this show is about. My point is that basically when you join a society like the Rugby Society, you are aware of some sort of expectation of what may occur. Now, did they go too far? That's for individuals to decide, and that's for the members of the rugby unions to decide. But ultimately, the idea of the initiations is something that you are aware of when you join. And by joining, you probably have some desire to take part in those things.
Just so the listeners are aware, we did ask the rugby team and for the SU to come, but none of them got back to us. So
there wasn't a sink.
No, there was no sink. And Blimey. David needs to speak now.
Yeah, I think the problem with what Kieran is advocating here is it's a question of inclusivity. It's a question of... treating an ease as an ought, to use the philosophical term. The idea that because rugby lads culture, let's call it what it is, banter, comes down to...
Don't ever say that again, David.
Well, what it comes down to is that this is thought of as, this is how rugby players are. But the problem is, if you accept that, then you're right. Only people who are willing to get involved in that banter will necessarily be
Stop
the people
it,
who want to get involved in that organisation. You look at the Law Society, for instance. I don't know what they're like now because I don't keep up with all of that undergraduate piff-paff. But in my day, the Law Society was one of the most exclusive organisations, one of the most cliquey things, because they had things like hustings, because they had everything that rugby team did. So everything that you said about the Politics Society and people telling them where to go, essentially, Law Society was a very expensive club to join so that you could go around and drink a lot of booze. And it didn't do much to unite people of the law school. It didn't do much to unite people in pursuit of careers or any of the other things that you might expect from a law society. The problem is that it only attracted a very small amount of people into the executive in that environment. And I think exactly the same is true of rugby. Just because you play rugby doesn't mean that you subscribe to these sorts of values. There's horseplay, and then there's banter, which is just a distinction. It's just a way of hiding the fact that you're bullying these people and you're expecting them to get on with it because you feel that it's okay and you're imposing that judgment on them. It's unacceptable, and we should stamp it out.
I totally agree with you, David. Not about how you say banter, but I think that's...
It is banter, David.
It's a horrible word. Nobody should ever say it. That's my point.
I just wanted to kind of raise the point about kind of lads culture, which I think is a disgusting thing anyway. I don't know if anyone's been on the internet recently. Don't.
What's I've that? Heard of it.
What's that? It's a horrible thing.
While I've been using my slide rule, yeah.
I saw a thing on from Impact the other day about the Chunder Dragon. Now, I was quite interested to see what that actually looked like, and
Did you try?
Well, no, I didn't try it, because what it is you throw up whilst flinging your arms around and shouting Chunder Dragon.
Oh, lovely.
How do you shout and throw up at the same time?
Well,
what are the mechanics of that?
Shouting and then throwing up at the same time.
Let's not go into the medical aspect of this.
We're university people. We sound very old today.
Well, I am quite old, so, you know, I'm allowed to sound quite old. And, I mean, I don't know about, you know... nowadays, but when I drink, I don't want to throw up. I don't really want to take my clothes off anymore. I just kind of want to go to bed and with a hot Horlicks and hope that my head doesn't hurt too much in the morning. But I do think that there needs to be some kind of reining in of lads culture in societies, because if it gets out of hand, you get to situations when people are really doing things they don't want to. And that's when, you know, you can get violence breaking out if you're really pressuring someone into doing something. And you've got a lot of alcohol involved and you're really going for it. And then someone punches someone in the face and the next thing you've got is someone going through a window or something. And I really think that's something that the university, for a start, wants to avoid. And the clubs should also understand that they need to avoid it as well, so they don't look bad on a national stage.
Okay, well, Kieran's got something to say, countering that, probably. But just before that happens, I want to say quickly, what do you think about it actually being banned over the varsity period? I mean, this is probably a message to the rugby team that they're, you know, we're not letting you do varsity this year. Should that be the case? Or should they just have the ban, like, at usual term time, so stopping them playing, but not the varsity game? Seb?
At first, when I saw the dates of it, it did seem strange that it wasn't, you know, going into effect, you know, straight away. But having said that, clearly it's not an accidental decision to have it take place during varsity. It is in order to make it a far harsher punishment. And I certainly agree with that, them being banned over. And I think it's hard to say exactly whether it doing varsity or not is right without knowing too much of the details. But it does sound like a strong signal needs to be sent out that you're going to let the whole university and, in fact, you know, that you would have been Trent opponents down. So I think it probably is correct that it was done to send a really very strong signal.
Yeah, I think it's acceptable. And I think, you know, I go back to something that was said right at the start of this debate, that it's going to affect not just the team themselves, but also the fans of the sport who really like the varsity event. It's one of the main talking points of the year. It's one of our, you know, it contributes to that Nottingham-Trent-Nottingham rivalry, which I think is mostly in good taste. If there is an acceptable use of the word banter, I think it does apply to that Trent Uni rivalry in the varsity series. And so I think, you know, this is an attempt to send a message to those fans. Look what these people who were representing you, your university, look what they were doing. We don't accept that, and you shouldn't either. And, you know, I applaud that. I think, you know, it could be interpreted as a rather harsh punishment, but I think it's worth it for that sort of expressive function.
I think it's a maximum impact punishment, really, isn't it? I mean, if you're gonna do something to any of the, sorry, people are dancing, and I don't understand why. It's very strange. Anyway, it's a maximum impact punishment. They're punishing the rugby team. I think it might be a little bit of a show trial as well, to kind of say to the other sports teams, you know, stick to the rules, do what you're told, or this is the consequence. And I think that, you know, possibly that is acceptable.
If it's a punishment regarding like the generalisation of lad culture within our society, then maybe it's acceptable. If it's a punishment just to tell them that they shouldn't be pooing into sinks, then it's probably not acceptable.
Okay, very quickly, I just want to talk about, because we know we're not going to be able to show... Okay, right, very quickly, I'm going to have to stop talking now, because we're going to the song. Now, thank you very much for listening to The Big Picture tonight. We've enjoyed being with you, listening to us. We've been enjoying talking to you, exactly, Johnny.
I've enjoyed listening to myself.
Yep.
And I've enjoyed listening to David as well, can I just say?
Okay, I haven't
later,
on
darling,
privatisation. Maybe we'll have that discussion later.